The topic has to do with multinational chapter 11s or 15s or cases. And why is my check not here yet? That's another subcontext of this. We have three speakers who I guarantee you will not put you to sleep. The first one is Marsha Goldstein, who is the chair of the Business Finance and Restructuring Department at Weil, Gotshal & Manges. I think technically Harvey Miller works for her. She was the lead restructuring counsel in General Growth Properties, also lead debtors counsel in extended stay, internationally with Parmalat and Eurotunnel, never mind the little cases. Those are two of the biggest that I can remember. She also was in Regal Cinema, the Washington Group that we heard about a little bit earlier this today, AMF Bowling Worldwide, Oxford Automotive, and some others. Andy Rawl has a similarly impressive resume. He is with Reed Smith, and he is also very active generally in ad hoc committees, both equity and debt, including Washington Mutual and Nina Enterprises. He was, I think, best known for being named one of the nation's outstanding bankruptcy lawyers six times by Turnaround and Workouts. Joe Radecki is someone I've worked with. Joe and I first worked together representing the Unsecured Creditors Committee of Flagstar, also known as Denny's Restaurants, and then also on National Energy Group, which is one of Carl Icahn's notable losses. And he is currently with the managing director and head of restructuring and special solutions with Lincoln International. And prior to that, he was leading the restructuring advisory processes practice at Piper Jaffray, CIBC before that, and then before that at Jeffries. So who wants to start?
Thanks, Hugh. I'm just going to begin very briefly with a little bit of an introduction. Marsha is going to follow with an outline of planning for a large multinational case. Joe Radecki will talk a bit about Grace. Very interesting at this point. Marsha's going to come back and talk a little about Lehman, and then I will cover some things about litigation trusts. And we'll have a bit of a panel discussion. I think to tie in with the theme of this conference every year, of course, is distressed investing. And I guess one question we're going to pose and try to address in different ways is what are distressed investors really buying? If they have you can talk traditionally about the distinction between control investors who are looking to influence the management of the company, the course of the reorganization, what have you, and presumably get an equity return in the end, as opposed to trading, which, of course, is not necessarily inconsistent with being a control investor, but often a great many players trade almost exclusively and really aren't all that concerned with the outcome of the case. So what are the factors that influence them? Well, obviously, there's a lot of volatility in any ongoing restructuring or bankruptcy case, often, not always, but often driven by legal factors, legal considerations, and legal developments in the case. Who objects to what, which way the judge goes on particular issues, and we're certainly going to cover some of that. And then the key concepts that influence all this, again, Marsha's going to talk about planning, how the case is set up, where it's filed, I'll leave that all to her, obviously has a huge, can have a huge impact on the outcome of the case, the progress of the case. Another issue that I know Steve Gittemau spent some time on this morning, but that is a major factor today, is the macro economic and monetary environment, fiscal environment that we're in. One of the themes I think that will come out is that what we are going to talk about in many ways is the opposite of what was suggested in the write-up for this panel, particularly the theme, and of course there was a time when this was a theme with a lot of validity, but the idea that delay in the progress of reorganization is a bad thing for investors. I think you're going to hear, number one, quite the opposite, certainly in the case of Grace, and some of the things I think Marcia's going to touch on. But I can't emphasize enough, and I hope we'll get to this, where where we are in this macro environment we find ourselves in and how important that's going to be going forward this year, next year, in the short to medium term, what to watch for and what effects different outcomes will have. And obviously the other sort of principle, who's in charge of the case or the restructuring in any particular stage that it's in, and I think we'll get into that as well. But with that, I'd like to kick it over to Marcia.
Okay, thank you. You know, I know that Andy is very focused on what the distressed investor is looking for. And you may think that what I am going to talk about, which is planning for a multinational, I'll call it a situation, because you may or may not need bankruptcy. You certainly may or may not want a bankruptcy for all the entities involved. But it is something that I think as an investor you should think about and understand in terms of how the case is set up and how it's structured, and get into the head of those who have to execute the case on the company side so that you can think better about where in the capital structure you might want to invest. And so on that note, I would start with a fundamental premise in terms of any multi-debtor case. Doesn't even have to be a multinational case, is assuming you have, unlike a Lehman where you don't have the luxury of time, but let's skip that one for a minute. I'll get back to Lehman. But if you have the luxury of planning to do what we sometimes in-house call a domino analysis, which is where's the liquidity event, where's the default, what is going to happen, and then figure out from there what in the enterprise will fall, can fall, or is doomed to fall. Do you want to prevent any of that? Do you want to protect, for example, a joint venture, whether or not it's co-owned by a foreign enterprise? Do you need to create new entities to protect parts of the enterprise from going through the bankruptcy because it might be detrimental to value? And we look at an international situation, a multinational, in very much the same way. There are some situations, I'll go back in time a little bit to a WorldCom, where one of the objectives of the planning was to make sure that the international network stayed intact. Why? That was a huge part of the value of the enterprise. Couldn't afford to have any of those end up in insolvency proceedings in multiple countries. What's the big issue when you're doing your planning in that area is how do you make sure they have enough capital, enough cash? Because at the time, in some countries, if you don't have enough cash to pay your bills for the next 60 days, the local directors are going to force the bankruptcy to protect themselves. So there's a lot of cash management planning on an international bankruptcy. The other thing to think about in terms of multi-debtor planning is what kind of company is this? And what kind of restructuring is this? Is it an operational restructuring or just a financial restructuring? I always find there's a lot more flexibility when it's a financial restructuring. Chances are a lot of the debt is issued to U.S. holders, and you can use Chapter 11 perhaps more effectively, notwithstanding the multinational nature of the situation. You might be able to get away with the focus of the multinational case being a U.S. Chapter 11. You might need some ancillary proceedings somewhere, but hopefully not. If it's an operational restructuring, be wary, because if you think you're going to effectively, for example, reject burdensome contracts in a U.S. case, but those contracts have counterparties in foreign jurisdictions, that rejection may not hold up the way you want it to in a U.S. bankruptcy. Damages might not actually be limited because a foreign court might not enforce those judgments. We've looked at those situations, and then you have to think about the use, the selective use of a foreign proceeding, particularly on operational restructuring. The foreign landscape is changing, especially in Europe. There's a new restructuring statute in Germany where there actually can be a restructuring. But you're still going to have to be coordinating with an appointed official, something we don't have here. And control of the chapter, and I know Andy talked about who's in control. Huge issue. In the U.S., we know who's in control, at least at the beginning of a Chapter 11 case, the debtor in possession. Not true in most other jurisdictions. Even in a Canadian case, a CCAA, where the debtor is in possession, you have a monitor. There may be an advantage to having your case, arguably CCAA is a more flexible statute. Maybe a good argument. Sometimes you have a cross-border between the U.S. and Canada to take the case through the CCAA and do a 15 here or vice versa. But the point is there's no one-size-fits-all with respect to planning for the multinational case. Today with the Chapter 15, you want to think about, do you want to start a Chapter 11 first so that you can have a plenary case here, or is there going to be a foreign proceeding first and then have a limited Chapter 11 or a Chapter 15 here? Each of these approaches has a different consequence. Are you going to work with a jurisdiction where there's a precedent for administrators or monitors to cooperate with the U.S. company, maybe arrange joint hearings for selling, as they did in Nortel, for example, for selling assets on a cross-border basis? Or are you going to work with a jurisdiction, or are you going to try to avoid having bankruptcies in jurisdictions where the walls are going to come down, where the cash that's in that jurisdiction will always be in that jurisdiction, where the administrator will run the case on a totally independent basis, and you're no longer dealing with an enterprise. You're dealing with a situation where walls come down. And I would mention this specifically since we are talking about not just corporate operating entities but financial companies, whether they be insurance companies or Lehman-like companies, that in a financial institution or a regulated entity, the walls will come down on insolvency. You will have immediate separation of broker-dealer, bank, foreign broker-dealer, foreign bank, with administrators with conflicting interests, and SIPC trustees, maybe a Chapter 11 trustee, as we also have in MF Global, which have to pursue the statutory objectives of the statute and the regulatory agency that governs them. That actually is one of the exercises, as some of you may know, under Dodd-Frank and the living will, is to figure that all out, lay it out, what will happen in terms of a multinational bank or multifaceted financial institution so that the regulators understand what will happen. And so the planning aspect has almost become a regulatory requirement. Not that it will ever happen that way, because we know that it will never happen exactly the way you think about it today, because facts and circumstances will dictate what happens in reality. But it forces financial institutions, certainly, to think about it and to think about their own structures today based on things that have happened in recent cases. Shared employees, shared IP, all those things become massive problems when walls come down in a multinational situation where you actually have multiple proceedings, particularly exacerbated in a financial institution or a regulated company. So with that starting point, Andy, I'm going to stop talking about planning unless you want me to answer a specific question and move on.
Okay, let's. Can we get the slides up for Mr. Radecki, please? I've asked Joe to join this panel and speak a little about GRACE. Joe represents the future claimants, the future asbestos claimants representative in GRACE, which, as he will tell you, is one of the longest running, certainly major, prominent major cases out there. And the future claims representative stands in the shoes, if you will, of The bankruptcy code was changed to allow for, if you will, the processing of asbestos claims in the bankruptcy context. The futures claim, the future claims claimants representative fulfills the role of looking after those interests. And Joe, now with Joe's slides up, I'll turn it over to Joe.
Yeah, and I'll expound a little bit about what Andy just said. I mean, the future claimants rep, asbestos bankruptcies are different than other bankruptcies in that the bankruptcy code, as Andy said, was changed to accommodate a bankruptcy where significant amounts of claimants are going to appear in the future. They have already been exposed to asbestos, but don't yet have not yet manifested the disease. There's a significant latency period up to 40 to 50 years. And so the bankruptcy code had to come up with some way to accommodate that sort of claim, which is very different than a normal bankruptcy where all your or most of your claimants are known day one. As Andy said, I've been in the Grace case now for a significant period of time representing the FCR. Some people think the FCR has the greatest job in the world. He's there acting on behalf of people who are going to get sick at a certain point in the future, but are not yet sick from asbestos. The reason it's a great job is because your client is so completely ephemeral. The minute they actually get sick, you no longer represent them. They go into the current asbestos claimants. So it's a very strange role inside of bankruptcy. As Andy said, Grace is one of the, if not the longest bankruptcy of all time. It actually, certainly of this size, filed in April of 2001 at a time when a lot of other companies like Federal Mogul, USG, and the like were filing because of their asbestos problems and a real lack of either a judicial through the Supreme Court class action cases or a congressional ability to solve asbestos litigation. Amazingly, Grace is still in bankruptcy today, and there is not yet a very clear end in sight. The early part of the bankruptcy was consumed with litigation with various parties for which Grace had sold entities to them years ago, as many of the creditors inside the Grace bankruptcy claimed some sort of fraudulent conveyance had occurred as those entities had gone out for less than fair value at a time where Grace was insolvent. And that led the courts to, you know, consider and the parties ultimately to settle on whether or not Grace was in fact insolvent, i.e., did you need to account for at the time of the those asset sales, could someone had reasonably come to a conclusion that Grace was already insolvent based on their potential future asbestos liabilities? And the court essentially found that you could. After many years of litigation, Grace finally reached settlement with its personal injury asbestos claimants back in April 2008 and the property damage claimants at the very end of 2008. So long story short, it took obviously a significant period of time to get from there with all the parties in asbestos bankruptcy, not only the current claimants and the future claimants, but also all the insurers, lenders, and other parties who are impacted by the bankruptcy to come to a point where you could get through a contested plan confirmation. Once we had gone through, I think, close to 20 full days of confirmation hearings or whatever, the plan was confirmed in end of January 2011. Asbestos bankruptcies are also a little different than normal bankruptcies in that they are automatically go on appeal to the district court for district court judges to rule. That process took exactly 1 year, and Grace made it through the district court level in 2012. Unfortunately for Grace and probably for some others involved in the case, this was not the end of the trail. Grace, the plan is currently on appeal to the Third Circuit. I think seven or eight different parties involved in the bankruptcy have appealed. No timetable set as to when that appeal will ultimately be decided, but you know, to the point where Grace, which had been Grace's management team, which had continually predicted, like many management teams, that it would be out of bankruptcy any month now or any quarter now, has stopped predicting. This could be another full year or two before the Third Circuit gets to this. Go through real quick just so you have a factual background, because it's such an unusual bankruptcy, and we'll get to that in a second as to how it, you know, it financially proceeded as opposed to all the litigation for asbestos. Unsecured creditors in this case are really receiving cash for the full amount of their claim plus post-petition interest. And in fact, one of the big litigations and certainly discussions internally has been what's the right rate of interest to give those claimants. Some have getting their contractual rate. Some are receiving a date that's akin to a federal judgment rate. Some had a contractual rate for a portion of their time in bankruptcy and then agreed a settled upon amount thereafter. And some parties, including one of the appellants in appellees, Marcia, help me here,
the
lawyer.
Well,
one of the parties appealing is
the appellant
is actually is a bank lender group that not only wants interest but wants default interest and has had both the bankruptcy court and the district court rule against them to date. The Asbestos Trust is actually receiving $250 million in cash, and interest is, in fact, ticking away on that. 18 million shares of Sealed Air stock.
What's the rate, Joe?
The rate is it is set at their bank, essentially what they're going to be able to borrow at when they come out of bankruptcy to ensure that the trust is no worse off from that point. Sealed Air, part of the Sealed Air settlement, they receive 18 million shares of Sealed Air stock, as well as $512 million of cash plus 5.5% interest compounding annually from 2002. So significant bite there. Fresenius, which was another party that had garnered an asset sale from Grace, is paying $115 million. All the insurance proceeds from the various insurers. Deferred payments starting in 2019 annually of $110 million each, and then after that, 5 years, another 10 years worth of $100 million each, as well as 10 million warrants struck at $17 a share, which was about the price of Grace stock at the time the asbestos claimants finally came to agreement. Also, there's also a property damage trust, $30 million in cash plus interest, a $30 million deferred payment, as well as additional up to $80 million payments, depending on how certain conditions, primarily litigation and some asset sales, are met. Now, what is this meant for everybody? It's created a very strange dynamic all throughout the case. I've thrown up there the Grace stock performance price over years. It's not many times, first of all, not many times you see a debtor in bankruptcy for 11 years. You certainly don't want to see one start out. It's not unusual to have a public company like Grace start out with its stock around $2 a share at the time of the bankruptcy, but that usually represents, as we all know, the optionality in that stock, that stock price, or some amount of inelasticity at the bottom of the price range, people unwilling to sell because the equity is out of the money. What is unusual is the other end of the chart. Grace is now currently selling at over $60 a share, has a market cap of, I think, over $4.3 billion, and that's not a usual occurrence inside of a bankruptcy. And that $4.3 million market cap is in addition to the types of payments that you saw that are already sort of factored in and going out the door to the asbestos claim. So I guess I would say this. Grace will one day be a case study of what I'm not 100% sure yet because, because you know, we haven't heard the moral of the story because we're not exactly at the end of it. It does hark back, I think, to an old phrase, though, that if you can't be part of the solution, it's pretty profitable to be part of the problem. You know, the people that have invested in the equity over the time here have seen a couple things go their way. Number one, as Andy earlier indicated, a lot of bankruptcies especially those in delay, are impacted by case events, whether that's litigation or otherwise. In this particular case in Grace, both the Sealed Air litigation obviously contributed significant dollars, one. Two, what was going on in the state courts and the like with regards to asbestos litigation and the like cut very much in the way toward those Grace investors. On the other side of that equation, the Grace went down a track early in the bankruptcy, pretty much through 2008 in the settlement, in which they tried to implement a different regime for settling those asbestos claims judicially or in litigation inside the bankruptcy court than others had gone down. And that strategy ultimately, while brought the parties to settlement, ultimately failed. So there's been, for the equity investors, a fair bit of back and forth. The second thing we see, and we'll ultimately see in some case study Grace, is, you know, not many times do you get to track general market fluctuations over the years inside of an individual bankruptcy or whatever. And here we have an 11-year case study that you can track how a couple things, not only how what the macroeconomic climate has been at certain times, i.e., I would point in the chart to November of 08 and obviously the difficulties that the market generally ran into there, but also, you know, how the company performed during this. You know, Grace has been able to treat certainly the last few years of the bankruptcy as though they were not in bankruptcy. You don't normally see public companies in bankruptcies going out and holding quarterly investor conference calls or courting research analysts on the street like you see Grace do. And some of that is to the credit of the management team at Grace, which on a large multinational company with more than 40% of its operations overseas and really non-debtors, has been able to manage the overall enterprise as though it were any other large multinational and do so very profitably. The last thing I would mention is there's also one other security here that's been an interesting play, particularly for a lot of hedge funds, and that is Grace's bank debt. They went into this with about $500 million of drawn unsecured bank debt, and that's been a significant security for Grace in terms of the bankruptcy, particularly in terms of the litigation. As I said, some of the hedge funds have been, early in the case, the Unsecured Creditors Committee reached agreement with Grace prior to the settlement with the asbestos creditors that said, if you get us X from the asbestos creditors, we agree to, you know, receive the par plus a stated rate of interest. Grace set that settlement down in letters with the Unsecured Creditors Committee. Unfortunately, then, the Unsecured Creditor Committee members all traded out of the debt. So Grace was left with an agreement they thought they had, and it was questionable whether they had. At the time they finally reached settlement with the asbestos creditors, some parties who had traded in the debt said, okay, that's great. You've left behind significant value for equity. How about our default interest? And that's been one of the ongoing litigations. Still under appeal at this time. Judge Fitzgerald in the bankruptcy court has denied default interest based on the fact that, ipso facto, the securities were not, one, they're unsecured, two, they were not in bankruptcy at the or in default in any way at the time of the bankruptcy. Three, the maturity of the security after the bankruptcy had been ongoing for a couple of years didn't impact that default consideration. So far she's upheld this settlement despite the fact that nobody who agreed to it still exists in the case. It's been an interesting trading vehicle because people have been trading it obviously based on the litigation aspects of whether or not they ultimately believe they can receive that default interest. And after, you can guess, 11 years worth of compounded interest, that's a pretty big number at this point. Security is currently trading at about 193% of par after all those years. If they were to have received their regular interest or the interest on their plan, I think it's about 186, 87, somewhere in there of par, but default interest would put it out at 230 something. 40 points on $500 million is a fair number even in a case of this size. Turn it back to you, Andy.
Okay. Well, so I guess one lesson from Grace certainly is that in this environment of low interest rates and low inflation, as Steve Gittemal pointed out this morning, when you got an interest rate on your return that was fixed at a time of much higher rates, most people in that case are quite happy to just stay right where they are until the rest of it's resolved, and presumably their value is accreting at a rate far above the rates that most people are getting with other investments.
Certainly at 5.5% coming from Sealed Air, the trust is not in as big a hurry to get out of bankruptcy as you would otherwise think.
Yeah, question.
Good question. I mean, what it really amounts to is the key factor for some of the parties in the case has been the protection, the injunctive protection offered by Section 524G, which is the section of the bankruptcy code that deals with asbestos litigation and getting, you know, essentially getting injunctive, future injunctive relief from those parties, those releases. A key component, at least, of the Sealed Air litigation was that Sealed Air got a 524G injunctive protection so that they can't come back, indemnification, so they can't come back against Sealed Air. To date, Sealed Air has not wanted to waive that particular conditions, and without a final order of the Third Circuit, well, you know, it's not closing.
Oh, so part of the Sealed Air's consideration by 512.5 and the shares is the actual
They got they needed 524G protection, which we're not able to offer them by in any way, you know, mooting the case until it's gone through the full appeals process.
I could just make another point on that, and you know, asbestos cases are somewhat unique, but in general growth, we also have an appeal, actually was argued this morning in the Second Circuit, involving default interest. But in that situation, the creditors agreed with the company not to hold up confirmation because it was a cash pay situation and the bank debt holders wanted the cash. I could see, and I know in Grace it's complicated by other aspects, but perhaps, you know, the creditors certainly on the default interest issue, you know, would just as soon let this hang around for a while.
Right.
And, you know, creditors are fairly, you know, have, I don't want to use the word control, but certainly play a role in how long something takes.
Grace would otherwise love to be out of bankruptcy, but it's not really impacting them negatively. There might be some slight effect on the stock prices. Some mutual funds are prohibited from holding stock in bankrupt companies, and accordingly they're not, you know, they're not able to access those investors or whatever, but their operations certainly at this point are not being impacted. The trust is, although it's not able to pay current claimants, it's accruing interest at, you know, a fairly good clip above and beyond what it could do in the marketplace, probably on its own. As Marcia said, the default defaulted bank lenders, bank debt lenders, don't appear to be in any hurry to settle the case or whatever. Sealed Air would like its 524G protection and doesn't want to proceed otherwise. So we're kind of hung up here until the Third Circuit comes back to us.
Thanks, Joe. Now, again, on the subject of timing as opposed to delay, timing, I'm just going to ask Marcia to say a few things about the timing of recoveries in Lehman.
Sure. I just want to add one other thing on the default interest. We may end up with a split in the circuits. In general growth, the bankruptcy court approved the default interest. The debtor took the appeal in that case. And so you have an appeal pending now with many of the same factors as the Grace case in the Second Circuit. The Grace Circuit Court decision will probably trail behind the Second Circuit, but it is quite possible the two courts can come out differently. Admittedly, these are fact-based issues in terms of default interest, but some of the issues, including ipso facto, a default interest not being in place before the filing, et cetera, are quite the same. So for those of you who find that interesting, and I'm sure most of you do, watch it. On Lehman, you know, I think we've heard on Grace that, you know, the email blast that seemed to be, you know, castigating all these cases for a delay and saying, oh, my God, you know, distributions are delayed. Well, it's not so bad in Grace because everybody's making money. And I took issue with that. You know, full disclosure, I think you all know Weil represents the Lehman estate. But I certainly took issue with any implication that that has moved slowly, given that it is the largest Chapter 11 case in history, had a confirmed plan in just over 3 years, which I don't think anybody expected. And not only that, but the plan was confirmed with settlements of, you know, all the multi-issues that you get in these cases, subcon, recharacterizations, intercompany balances, et cetera. So, and I know Andy was really talking about timing as opposed to delay. So I took issue with that. So I thought I would challenge that or that assumption. In Lehman, just a little bit of statistics. The plan provides for semi-annual distributions, obviously agreed to by the creditors, and Lehman has already made two distributions totaling $33 billion, not a small amount. An additional $12 billion of cash is restricted, and it's held with respect to certain disputed claims that had not been allowed on those agreed distribution dates. So, in addition, at LBHI, the parent company, and LCPI, another significant debtor in the case, distributions have already totaled close to 50% of the disclosure statement recoveries. And certain derivative-related debtors' payout has already been over 100% of disclosure statement projections, others close to 70, 80, or 100% of projections. So, I think that given the magnitude of the estate and the number of claims, I think 70,000 claims were filed against the debtors. Thousands obviously have been objected to. We all know in a case like that how many claims get filed that may not be real. in any event, thousands have been objected to and expunged or reduced, and you know, there are just thousands that are left to resolve. So I would take the view that the distributions are moving along at a pace that is at least what was contemplated by those who negotiated the plan. Certainly ahead of distributions coming out of the SIPA estate of the broker-dealer Libby, and ahead of most other, Libby being the London proceeding, and ahead of most of the other foreign proceedings. So just, and I know people are interested in what's left, so I'll give you a little bit of that. Lehman's remaining assets, which include intercompany receivables, as you can imagine, have a great variety of liquidation timeframes. They publish cash flow statements that go out for the next few years. You know, some of those assets are harder to liquidate. And some are being held on to, and now that I've heard, you know, more detail about the Grace case, in an effort to maximize value. So sometimes waiting is better. But I thought that it was not only appropriate but important to at least challenge any assumption that that's been moving slowly given the size and magnitude of the amounts involved.
Well, we're just about out of time. I just want to say one other thing about litigation, which is, as an investor, you want to focus very closely on what kind of litigation trust it is, what the claims, if you think whatever claims are being assigned to the trust, sometimes it's just a routine assignment of garden variety avoidance claims. Often, though, in major cases, there could be some quite significant fraudulent conveyance or other liability claims that are being assigned to the trustee. There are really two kinds of trust. The traditional litigation trust, the important thing to focus on is that interests, beneficial interests in sort of a traditional standalone litigation trust generally are not transferable. In order to make the trust a tax-free pass-through and also to avoid securities law concerns about trading in trust interests, the typical approach is, the simpler approach, is to make those claims, those interests, non-transferable. That has obviously lots of implications, and I guess the point I want to make is that there certainly is another way to do it, which is that you can set up an entity in the context of a Chapter 11 plan to which you convey these claims, as long as you do it in a way with the understanding that that entity will have a security of some sort, which is distributed out to creditors or whoever whatever class or classes of creditors receive it in whatever the plan deal is. That's a very different kind of animal, but and you don't see it nearly as often. They're out there. But that's an interesting thing to focus on, certainly when it comes time to negotiate a plan in a situation where you think there are claims that have value. And, of course, obviously, a security, an interest in a security whose principal assets are litigation claims is, potentially subject to all of the volatility and other investment considerations that any litigation is. So I just throw that out. We're out of time. Any last questions? It's all yours, Hugh.